When I have dreams, fortunately, I don't have the bad dreams. My dreams are actually being back on that trauma team. Man, if you came to us and you were breathing, you had a pretty damn good chance of coming out of there alive. All I have to do is just think about my wife being in an emergency and calling 911 and having to wait, or having that fucking ambulance not show up. And I'm just like, it's almost bringing me to tears right now just thinking about it. I saw way more trauma in my time as a civilian paramedic than I did in my time as an Army medic. There should be a fleet of therapists attached to every ambulance company. I decided to take that risk because, you know, if these medics are risking their lives to go out there every day to help folks, that's the least I could do to dip my toe back out there and capture these stories.
My name is Sal Bancheter. I'm a retired New York City firefighter. I'm a New Yorker in and out. I actually come down here only once a year for 9/11 to remember the brothers and sisters that are no longer here. That day when the planes hit the towers, I got a phone call. Every single firefighter, you need to go and respond. And we came together that day. We didn't have masks. It was hot. There was a lot of dust, difficult to breathe at times. We were looking for survivors. We weren't looking for our safety at the time. Today, we're losing more than two firefighters per month towards cancer. We're going to be surpassing the 343 firefighters that died on 9/11. I lost too many friends, you know, towards cancer. And that's what kind of led me to being an advocate about getting checked regularly. What New York Cancer Resource Alliance puts out is that we have a ton of information out on a website, and it's more educational that we can present to a firefighter that he could do his research. A lot of these firefighters, you ask them and say, well, you know, I went to go see the doc. He tells me to come back in 4 years. Well, why 4 years? Did you tell him where you were? You know, did you tell him you were at the World Trade Center for 2 months working on a pile? You want to be able to be vigilant, and you want to be able to catch cancer or any other illness before it happens. That's what kind of led me to my Pinuvo experience. It was absolutely amazing. The staff was really great. The place was new, clean, state of the art. They put me in the machine. They take a look at your body. So it's taking a tremendous amount of imaging. It's not like a CT scan. It doesn't use a radioactive isotope. Pinuvo uses a different system called diffusion. And in an hour, I was basically out again. It was the patient care and it's the education. It was pretty cool. I mean, I was blown away. What I would say to firefighters is think of Pinuvo as a tool. It's not a miracle, it's early detection. You do it for yourself, you do it for your wife, you do it for your grandkids. And what I tell every firefighter, get checked now and don't let up the fight. My name is Sal, and this is my Pinuvo story.
Welcome to Respond Resilience, along with my co-host, Bonnie Romoli, LCSW, EMTB. I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Derek O. Hanley. He's the CEO of DOHP and the author about his book, Photos from the Frontlines, and the film, Honorable But Broken, EMS in Crisis. We'll also talk about the current EMS crisis and the state of first responder mental health. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness, Inc., bbsradio.com, all the podcast platforms, and check out our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Derek after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job.
In this family, up to a quarter of 911 telecommunicators have symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis,
while responders are quietly suffering.
In this family, many struggle with job-related stress,
burnout, trauma, sleep disruptions, substance abuse,
and relationship problems.
In this family, we can help the helpers
with vital information and resources,
resilience strategies,
and success stories of overcoming the obstacles.
In this family, no one is alone.
Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rimley, LCSW EMTB.
Derek Hanley here, a photographer, a videographer, a veteran combat medic.
Derek Hanley is with us today.
We have on the line with us Derek O'Hanley. What a remarkable book. Obviously, you had no idea when you embarked on this journey of embedding with paramedics and, you know, frontline responders. There was no way to know that a worldwide pandemic was on its way.
His goal was to document the day-by-day life-saving that they do. And now you can experience what it was like.
He's done a book that should be a coffee table book in homes and offices. You know, it's something in the office that somebody's going to pick up, look at, and be moved by. This is the book.
Our military protects us overseas. Our first responders are the ones who protect us at home. And we need to start thinking about what we can do to take care of medics like we do for our military.
The book is Photos from the Frontline.
Photos from the Frontline.
Photos from the Frontlines.
Photos from the Frontlines.
So that's dope. It's DOHP.net, and you can find Derek's book there.
Today, we're pleased to welcome Derek O'Hanley. He's a longtime paramedic and disabled veteran combat medic, author, and published photographer, also a multi-instrumentalist, noted video producer, and he's the founder of DOHP. Now, even though that bio is short, we have a lot to unpack, so looking forward to diving in. Derek, welcome to Respond to Resilience.
David, Bonnie, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. You know, with that bio, we could tell you're an underachiever, so we might have to motivate you some more here.
Sounds like it. Could be.
You know, we can't wait to just hear more about your journey. I'm very, very curious about the background of how you got to where you are now. And if you could talk to us a bit about your time in the Air Force and how that led you to where you are, that would be great.
Yeah, certainly. So I, you know, kind of had a tumultuous upbringing, my family life as a kid. And, you know, I think the kind of camaraderie of the fire department and the emergency services drew me in as kind of a home away from home, if you will, for those kind of dark days back then. And that, you know, being a firefighter, I very much enjoyed, but I was noticing that a lot of the calls we were going on were medical related. And it felt kind of weird to show up, you know, with the lights and sirens. And then you get there and you're like, I don't know what to do with my hands right now. I'm just a firefighter. Like, so I went, took a first responder course and an EMT course when I was in high school. And that was kind of the starting point of that arc of my journey, if you will. And, you know, I went, like I said, grew up kind of poor. It was tumultuous. So the military to me was my quickest ticket out of town. And when I went to the recruiter, I talked to them about becoming a firefighter. And they were saying something about how my vision didn't meet the requirement at the time. That's changed since then or whatever. But he was like, well, we have this, you know, this medic position. If you're interested in, you know, I see you have an EMT and this and that. And so I was like, okay, yeah, let's go with that. And so yeah, joined up right out of high school. 2000 is when I enlisted and went through the Air Force medic training down there in Shepherd Air Force Base, and then was stationed at Lackland Air Force Base, which was which is where Wilford Hall Medical Center was, which, if you know anything about the Air Force, it was the flagship of the Air Force medical program. It was basically where all the doctors, you know, surgeons, everyone did their training. Everyone, you know, it was the Air Force Trauma Center. So, you know, we got soldiers and airmen and stuff from overseas that were, you know, coming back who were injured and stuff. And plus we would, you know, we were a 911 ambulance service that operated out of the emergency department. So, you know, as a paramedic, we were operating at full scope in the ER. We were also responding to 911 calls in the base and the surrounding area. And we were also part of the trauma team. So whenever there are trauma team activations and stuff, there'd usually be two medics, you know, two ER nurses, you know, the docs, the whole rigmarole that came through. And so I was kind of bummed when I got stationed at Lackland because it's San Antonio. That's where you do your basic training. And you're like, man, I joined the Air Force to like go to Germany, Japan, you know, all the overseas bases I put on my dream sheet, they call it. And then they sent me back down to Lackland. I was like, all right. But, you know, as a medic in the Air Force, it was really the top of the food chain of where you could be. The best of the best, the tip of the spear were all at Wolford Hall and in the ER especially. And so that was really a great experience. And, you know, something unique about operating out of the emergency department is that you kind of, you know, a lot of times when you're a medic in the field, you drop your patient off and you don't know what happened. You know, I think it was this or I think it was that. And, you know, you don't really know. But there, we're able to come in, work with the trauma team, you know, bring them up through the x-rays and the CAT scans, you know, all the way up to the ICU and stuff like that. And, you know, you can be like, hey, doc, I thought it was this. And they'll be like, no, you're way off. Or like, yeah, you're right on the money. Look at the x-ray. And so really kind of helped to hone my paramedic intuition as far as, you know, clinical decision making and things like that. Because, you know, just the follow through and the and, you know, I could ask the docs endless questions, you know, throughout the day about the case. And we could, you know, go over it together and stuff like that. So it was really an awesome experience. And, you know, fortunately, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about mental health and things like that a little bit later on. But when I have dreams, fortunately, I don't have the bad dreams. My dreams are actually being back on that trauma team because, man, if you came to us and you were breathing, you had a pretty damn good chance of coming out of there alive because, you know, we were kicking ass. So awesome experience in the Air Force, and did my 4 years and got out. And because I was a young guy in his 20s, didn't want to, you know, take orders anymore. I wanted to go and kind of do my own thing, chart my own course, and try my hand at being a civilian.
Sounds like state of the art, and you had the kind of unmatched opportunity to see the patient through the process, but also get closure and learn along the way. So that's such a big kind of void in traditional EMS where, like you said, you drop off the patient at the ER and that's usually the end of it, the last we see of them and hear of them. So what a great experience.
Yeah. And I'd like to encourage any students I have to try and volunteer or work in an emergency department, especially a trauma center, things like that. Cause man, you watch those trauma surgeons go through their trauma assessment and you learn a thing or two along the way, that's for sure. And it really helps to see, you know, the kind of handoff of the baton to the emergency department, all the stuff that they need to do, because then it helps you to then prepare on the pre-hospital end to kind of make things as set up as possible. So that way it's a smooth transfer. You got as much stuff done for them as possible and things like that. So I think it's really good to get that in-hospital perspective of, you know, what happens after we drop them off. But yeah, I did the Air Force. I got out. I worked as a civilian paramedic for a couple of years up in New York. And I'll be honest, guys, I got burnt out. I was burning the candle at both ends. You know, I was volunteering on top of, you know, paid shifts and, you know, things like that. And it just got to be too much. And, you know, when we talk about this stuff, it's like I try to, you know, I was teaching EMTs for the last 5 years or so down in California before I moved up to Oregon here. And, you know, by the time I was, you know, leaving, probably a third of the class I was devoting to mental health and, you know, wellness and things like that. Because, you know, as an instructor, I don't want to send my students out with the lack of tools that I didn't have when I was sent out there. Cause if I had a lot of that stuff, maybe I could have stayed in the field longer and had, you know, coped health with more healthier ways to what I was seeing and, you know, being able to process, you know, a lot of the horror and stuff like that.
Come on. Check it.
What did you cover when you were teaching in terms of mental health?
A lot of it was from there's a dynamic mindfulness training that I went through. And it was, you know, I try to incorporate some sort of movement and body awareness and things like that into the practice, because A, it's, you know, it's a good thing to have as a personal thing, but as an instructor too, you know, you get these kids, it's an after school, it was like an after school high school EMT program. So, you know, they've just been in class all day. They're all scatterbrained and, you know, high on sugar and stuff. And so like, let's come together. Let's get centered. Let's get focused on this important information that, you know, I'm trying to convey here. So I usually start the class with some sort of kind of mindfulness practice, but I was bringing in yoga. I had, you know, just any of the stuff, any of the self-improvement stuff that I read, I was kind of bringing that in, and I would add that to some of the slides that I would have and just kind of give them little nuggets of bits along the way that I was picking up. So I'm like, hey guys, I'm 40 years old and I'm still learning this stuff. And, you know, anything that I'm learning, I'm going to give it to you so that way you can be as prepared as possible, you know, when you get out there in the field. So I think that's really what's missing. I think, you know, there's the wellness and the, you know, post-traumatic stress awareness and things like that are certainly better. And, you know, in the curriculum, they've added quite a bit of content about stuff like that. But I still don't think it's enough. I still think that people are, you know, we as instructors and program directors and things like that could be doing a much better job of bulking out the curriculum. You know, like, sure, the state gives you a minimum amount of hours you need to direct to the emergency curriculum, but, you know, on top of that, there should be a certain number of hours that, you know, we as educators say, hey, you know, we need a mandatory minimum for wellness training, so that way we're not putting these guys out there and they're burning out in 5 years, and then we're, you know, we have this huge churn in the workforce. So
I totally agree with you. And where I am, a few of the services asked me to come in and do our trauma lecture for the EMT class. So on the trauma team that I'm a part of, this is what we do. We go into departments and we take about an hour and a half, 2 hours, and really target PTSI and how to treat it, how to prevent it. I couldn't agree with you more. We need it more all across the board. It's obviously I'm biased, but I think it's more important than the skills, because if you have a shell of a human being there, how are they going to access all these wonderful skills that you're teaching them?
100%. Yeah. So yeah, I got kind of burnt out, and then I went and did trade work, you know, plumbing and construction and carpentry and stuff like that for a while. Basically anything that didn't have to do with patient care or, you know, high stress environments and things like that. And, so did that for a while when I went back to school, and then, moved out to California in 2012. Before that, when I was in school, I, you know, did a tour with the Army National Guard, as a medic. But that was a more mellow tour than my Air Force one. You know, the trauma center was just an unbelievable place to operate out of. But I did that while I was in school, and then, you know, moved out to California in 2012 to help my friend start a photography and video production business. Because he was already out there, and he, you know, had some equipment and stuff. So he's like, man, I need a partner to help get this thing going. So packed up everything, moved to California from New York, and then you know, we had a pretty good thing going there. We did a lot of awesome projects. We did a feature length film down on the island, South Pacific island nation of Tonga. If you ever heard of that, it's a very small little island nation. And it was the first narrative feature length film to be shot in the Tongan native language. It was actually kind of a comedy film, but everything was in the Tongan native language. We did all the filming down there. It was an incredible time. We got some incredible shots. Beautiful place there. Beautiful people too. Everyone was just the nicest you can imagine. So welcoming and so jazzed to have people, you know, down there and featuring Tongan folks. And so we did stuff like that. We worked with a lot of professional athletes. You know, we did corporate stuff, CEO things, and, you know, so I kind of got that kind of pomp and flair of commercial photography. On the job training. And, you know, throughout that I was still teaching EMTs and, you know, keeping my toe in the field that way. But yeah, I worked with him for a couple of years, built up the business, sold off my share, and then kind of started my own business and photography stuff. And then, you know, in 2020, January 2020, I got a position behind the scenes doing research with Alameda County EMS, and And so in February 2020, I was like, well, hey, man, I've been with the company a little bit. Like, I'd love to get out with the troops in the field and see what it's like. Because, you know, I've worked in Texas. I've worked in, you know, New York, but I've never been a paramedic in the Bay Area. So I'd love to just see what the system's like, see what these guys are facing on a daily basis, and, you know, just see what it's like out there. So started doing some ride-alongs with the crews, and then was like, why don't you bring your camera with you? You know, these guys are doing some awesome stuff. You're on these crazy scenes. Like, you know, I did that a little bit when I was in the Air Force. That back then it was just when you're getting cameras small enough to be able to fit in your pocket. Right. They weren't on everyone's phones and stuff. So I had a camera with me when I was in the military capturing a little bit of stuff. But this time I was like, you know, these guys do so much amazing work. And most people don't know what the paramedic does on a daily basis, even their own family members. You know, you can tell them, oh, we did this, we did that. But, you know, to actually see someone on the job, you know, to me, it was like, that'd be the coolest thing to give someone, to show their kids, to show their grandkids, their family, like, hey, look what daddy does on a daily basis. See daddy being a hero, or, you know, look at mommy doing this rad stuff. Like,
yeah,
I thought it would be a cool thing to just have people be able to feel some pride in what they do, because I feel like that's another thing that's kind of missing in the field too, is just people being honored, people feeling pride and nobility for what they do, because they should.
Probably it's easier, like, for firefighters to bring their kids along for a ride along. I know I've had my son on, you know, stay with me during a 24-hour shift, but probably not so easy. And, you know, it's got different kinds of issues, brings a kid or someone on a ride along on an EMS unit. So you really went behind the scenes. And the other thing I loved what you did, Derek, is the fact that you're kind of portraying the real EMS world, not what we see in stock photography and, you know, the occasional movie where EMS is portrayed. It's a whole different look, right? It's like, I'm sure you'll get into this. You captured kind of the depth of COVID that affected everybody and how that changed responses and just operating the kind of gear and also interagency responses. There's a lot of photos you have where you're showing not only EMS, but law enforcement, fire. So talk a little bit about the book, the photos, and what you're trying to accomplish with the book besides portraying what EMS world is like.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess that brings us right to the next step of the story, which is March 2020. COVID strikes, lockdown in the Bay Area, and, you know, the world changed. And that was, you know, my position was essentially a work from home position at that point. And it was so, it would be so easy to just kick back and, you know, sit on my couch and just watch things unfold through my phone. But I knew that these folks were still going out there every day. They didn't have the option to work from home. And not only did they not have the option, they're walking into, you know, a battle zone, essentially. They're risking their life every call, every time. It's an invisible enemy. we really don't have any tools to fight it. We don't have any information about how it spreads, what's going on, how bad is it, what's the fatality rate. You know, there's so much, at that point, there was so much unknown. It was just like an ever ballooning weight of uncertainty that was unfolding on the whole world, but especially the folks who are having to respond to this stuff. And, you know, I said to myself, you know, there's risk involved, obviously, of putting yourself out there in the field if you don't have to be, especially in the beginning. You know, we're wearing cloth masks, there's no vaccine, you know, we don't know, again, about transmission and stuff like that. So it was a risk, but I decided to take that risk because, you know, if these medics are risking their lives to go out there every day to help folks, you know, it's the least I could do to dip my toe back out there and capture these stories and, you know, these acts of heroism and bravery that would have just been unknown or a memory otherwise. And, you know, we kind of talked before the show started about a lot of the photos being in black and white. And that was a stylistic choice intentionally, because to me, it harkens back to the black and white photography, battleground photography from World War II. You know, in World War II, they actually sent, you know, Hollywood directors and photographers and filmmakers and stuff to the front lines to capture what was going on, because, you know, A, they needed to recruit, retain, get the public on board with, you know, why we're fighting and why we're sending these, you know, our men and women to go and fight and die and stuff like that. And to me, it was almost like no one cares about World War I because there were no photos, there were no videos, there was no one telling the story. But once they started pushing the photographers to the front lines in World War II, and they started sending their images back and people were seeing it, that's when they were like, whoa, this is what these guys are going through. Like, man, we should thank them for what they do. We should take care of their education, take care of their healthcare, like do whatever we can to support them, because man, that looks like a meat grinder that these folks are having to go through and deal with. And so I kind of wanted to, that's kind of the lens in which I was kind of reporting from the front lines from, was that kind of showing the public and showing everyone, like, look at what these guys are doing. You know, this is some, if you want to talk about service before self, if you want to talk about heroism and bravery, I'd love to see better examples within the last 3 years of of those qualities in people.
I was just going to say to you, you know, I rode hundreds of hours during COVID on the ambulance, and I was in charge of everybody during that time. And to me, when you talk about the black and white photography, it captures the mood. Things were very serious, very dark. And it did feel like a deployment. You know, you would go on these calls knowing that you would do your best, but there wasn't a lot that we could do because we didn't understand enough and we didn't have enough skills and knowledge base at the time. So I love your choice for both reasons. You know, I feel it really does capture such a dark time for all of us.
And that was, you know, that was the intention. And it was, like I mentioned, I come from a commercial kind of photography background. So trying to capture that kind of hero shot, giving them that kind of badass, you know, the these are badasses, man. Like, look at these folks. Like, that's kind of that's kind of how I was trying to bring my kind of commercial background into this documentary material. And I think the black and white also kind of helps to, you really focus on the kind of emotional state of the subject. Because some of those photos, you can just see the frustration, you know, one of the medic's mask, his one N95 that he's issued for the day breaks, you know, halfway to the hospital with a respiratory patient. And, you know, you see him pulling the ambulance out, like, you know, I'm standing on my hind legs trying to fight here, and I'm doing it with, you know, shitty gear. And, you know, back then, you know, he probably had similar things of, you know, the PPE shortage was making it so that they would turn their mask in on a one-to-one basis. They'd bring the mask back to the station and Lysol them and let him sit in a room for a week until the virus was dead, and then reissue them back to medics in the field. Like, what? Like, it's one thing to go into battle with your full body armor and your helmet and your weapon. It's another thing to go in with your, you know, your polo shirt. And that's what we were essentially doing to these folks, sending them out there without the stuff that they needed into these hazardous environments. And, you know, the other thing about this is that was unique about this battlefront. And in the book, I intentionally use military vernacular to tie these two professions together in people's minds of military and medic, because other than a soldier in combat, I would love to hear another profession that has the level of traumatic exposures as a paramedic or a firefighter or, you know, a law enforcement officer, that type of a thing. So to me, I tell people I was in the military and they're like, wow, thank you for your service and this and that. And it's, you know, thank you. I should be thanked for the service, but there's, you know, folks I served with who spent their 4 years in the logistics office on a base, you know, safe, and, you know, they should be thanked. Absolutely. They wrote a blank check up to and including their life. But I'll tell you what, I saw way more trauma in my time as a civilian paramedic than I did in my time as an Army medic all the years I served. So there's a huge gap in the public's level of honor for first responders, but especially in medics in my mind. So military vernacular is intentional, and, you know, what was unique about this battlefront is that you're not only risking your life, you're risking the lives of everyone who's close to you. Because if you get this thing and then you spread it to your family and they all get sick or they die or something, like, can you imagine? It's horrific. Now the pressure is ballooning even more for these folks. And, you know, not only do they have the uncertainty, but now I have the risk to myself and the risk to my family and my loved ones and everyone in my pod and this and that. So the stress levels that these folks were under is just, you can't articulate it, which is why I think photography and things like film are what we need to communicate to the general public, the stuff. Because, you know, it's one thing to talk about the pressure and the stress, but when you see it on someone's face and you see, you know, the blood in the car and you see, you know, all the milieu that goes into witnessing a what happens on an emergency scene. I think that that kind of visceral reaction that people get when they see photos and film and things like that is really what makes the change. And that's what I think, you know, goes back to the World War II thing of once people started seeing this stuff, that's when things like the GI Bill and the VA home loan and the VA healthcare system all came about after that time, because the public essentially demanded it because of what they saw of what these folks were doing.
When it comes to occupational cancer exposures, members of the fire service are some of the highest risk professionals nationwide. Firefighters Against Cancer and Exposures, also known as the FACES Foundation, is an advocacy organization established to bring awareness, resources, and peer support to responders in need of additional help in battling potential cancer diagnoses or critical concerns. The FACES Foundation was established by a national alliance of first responders to offer supplemental resources for firefighters. One of its core initiatives is cancer awareness in the form of prevention and early detection, supporting vigilance about occupational cancers and cancer recurrence through our national Get Checked Now campaign. Also, the FACES Foundation publishes a major public catalog of resources for the many areas of need, including information on clinical and mental health therapies, benefits and compensations, funding sources and financial strategies. For more information, please visit the FACES website at facesusa.org.
You know, what I see with clients a lot is that although our profession has to be secretive, it's very important. You know, HIPAA and confidentiality are paramount for all of us. But I think it also makes it so hard because people would probably be able to articulate more or share more. But I know a lot of the clients I see feel very bound and silenced, and they feel they have to carry that burden, not only because of the regulations, but also because they don't feel like their family or friends could handle the material, right? So we have the most difficult professions in the world, and everyone's keeping it to themselves or keeping it in-house, and we wonder why people are struggling. You know, we're asking people to do something impossible, I think. Which is why we're so passionate about the mental health piece. And I know you're bringing that up. You want to talk a little bit more about it. But we're grateful for people like you who are really using your background to shine a light on it, because civilians forget about us until they need us. You know, that's kind of the bottom line. And you can't blame them. It's not their world every day.
Yeah. And people don't take action until it directly affects them in general. Unless they've been shown something that's going to trigger something within them to take mm-hmm. action. So the book is kind of a way to just bring more visibility. That's mm-hmm. really the, you know, what people do with that, I can't control. But mm-hmm. to me, the visibility is the main piece in establishing that kind of chain of honor, if you will. Because to me, that's what's really missing. You know, it's one thing if you go and you see all this horror and you know, blood, sweat, and tears, trying to save lives, CP, you know, all the stuff you have to do. It may be worth it if, you know, after you got done, someone said, thank you. Like, mm-hmm. I appreciate what you've done. I honor what you've done. I understand what you've done. You know, thank you. We hold you on this pedestal for that. But to, you know, work for 5 years, work your ass off and, you know, save lives and then burn out and then, you know, fade away into nothing. That's mm-hmm. almost even more sad, you know? And so it's, mm-hmm. to me, it's like it all starts with honor. You know, if you honor something, then you want to take care of it and you want to make sure that it does well. And you know, there's more people that we can honor and come up and stuff like that. So to me, that's one of the main things from the public that's missing towards medics is that level of honor and,
understanding like
through
really.
Empathy. Through understanding and through empathy, that's kind of what I think can cultivate that. And that's kind of the side mission of the book is to, or the grand mission, if you will, is to produce more honor for medics within society.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds to me in doing that work, you're doing some repair work for you as well, because if you couldn't right the wrongs for yourself, you can try to right it for others. Right. And I think we all do that to some degree in our work on a daily basis.
It's been hard. It's been a hard journey. And you know, even doing stuff like this, these podcasts, it drags up the old stuff. And, you know, I'm sure you know that, you know, trauma networks are interconnected. And, you know, once you kind of light one, the whole network's going to light up and things like that. So it's tough. It's not easy. And, you know, 10 years ago, I I wouldn't have been doing any of this stuff. I was still closed down, still not talking about any of this stuff, still carrying everything. You know, the analogy I give my students is it's almost like wearing a backpack that has a cabinet, and in that cabinet, there are jars. Okay. So, you know, you see something bad and you just stuff it in the jar, put it in the cabinet. See another thing bad, you put it in the jar, you put it in the cabinet, and, you know, we're constantly adding more jars to this thing. And to me, therapy is almost like opening the cabinet back up, taking a jar off the shelf, shaking it up, and dumping some of it out. Maybe not all of it, but a little bit. And each time we do that, we kind of lighten that load a little bit. So it's you know, it's a journey. I'm still on that journey. I'm still in the process of trying to heal a lot of this stuff. And like you're saying, if we can make those who are still doing it and those who are coming up into the field a little bit more prepared and a little bit better taken care of, I mean, I think that's an imperative. You know, if you're not doing that, what are you doing? Like, how are you not helping these folks and doing what you can? And another thing that I think is kind of missing is the agencies themselves being proactive instead of reactive to mental health issues. Because it seems like a lot of it is reactive in nature of like, I'll just wait till they burn out and then they'll go see the EAP or they'll go to the therapist and, you know, they'll sort it out on their own. Whereas if I was looking at the situation and hearing the stories of what these folks are going through, I would be inclined to be extremely proactive. I would have things like a therapist in-house all day to debrief crews when they come back off their 12-hour shifts. Like, hey, go see Bonnie for your half hour after, you know, paid. Yeah, we're going to go debrief. We're going to go talk it out, things like that. Mm-hmm. You should also be monthly. have you know, there should be a fleet of therapists attached to every ambulance company to be seeing people monthly. There should be another arm that's there for as needed. You know, someone's always on who you can call and stop by if you need to make an appointment. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, someone who's debriefing crews as they're coming back out of the field each day. To me, that would be a minimum. That would be the minimum start that I would have towards beginning to address. That wouldn't cover everything. That wouldn't solve all the problems, but that would be the minimum starting point that I would work towards to start addressing and being proactive with this stuff. Because it seems to me that the amount of money that these agencies put into recruiting and retention and, you know, things like that, if you just dump that into a mental health force, you would solve your retention problem almost overnight, I would bet. You know, pay is one thing and, you know, honor is another, but, you know, just be having the mental faculties to be able to do the job, you know, people will do the job until they can't, you know, that's crazy. You know, like, let's keep the motor. Let's do some work on the motor while it's still at peak efficiency before it dies. And then, you know, we have to find someone new to come in. So that's another area which, you know, whenever I have a platform like this, I like to trumpet notions like this because I'm shocked it's not happening already. I was shocked during COVID. I was seeing all this stuff and like, how are you guys not, you guys aren't grasping the gravity of what's happening and how harsh, you know, the environment is for these folks and how they're going to be burning. Like, I could see it coming and I wasn't even in a command position. So, you know, it's baffling that this still isn't taking place. And I don't know what it would take to change it, but to me, that seems like a good first step. And I'm sure there are other experts who could add to that.
The good thing is we're starting to see, and some of our guests have brought this up, but we're starting to see more fire departments, police departments who are having embedded clinicians. So sadly, EMS is always the third, right? And then dispatch is after us usually. But I think it's starting, and I think there we will see a lot more of that in the future. I think we just need more of us. So now a lot of the first responders that are retiring are going into mental health and getting a degree in social work or counseling. And we encourage it because a lot of these people have lived it firsthand. They know the struggle. And kind of like you, they don't want to see anyone else go down that road. So I think we need more of us, more hands on deck, more therapists who understand first responders and first responder culture. But encouraging is that we're starting to see some of what you just brought up.
Yeah. I have seen a little bit of that coming through. There was a police department I worked with, Campbell PD in the Bay Area, and they had an embedded social worker who would see people regularly and, you know, kind of reach out and stuff like that. So it is coming. I'm not seeing it in the ambulance real feel right. that much.
Right.
But yeah, that's an issue. And this, you know, the we're going to talk about it, but, you know, the system's on the verge of collapse. And it's... Not only that, you know, y'all know it's the nurses, it's the doctors, it's, you know, anyone basically who's working in patient care or high stress, you know, public safety positions are, they're all burning out, you know, and then that's leading to the downward spiral of, okay, we're losing folks. So now the folks who are here have to work harder and work overtime and, you know, that's burning them out even faster. And, you know, it's this negative feedback loop that I can see it. And again, I'm not a big brain, you know, at the state EMS office, or, you know, I can see this coming. I'm just some Joe. One of the things that's coming up for me in this next year is going to be putting my talents towards this crisis. You know, we're going to talk about the film and stuff here in a little bit, I know, but I talked to Bill Seifarth, the CEO of the NREMT. He reached out to me recently because he's seen my photos and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. He heard about the film and he was like, man, I got a little bit of hope because, you know, no one else is doing anything to promote the profession and to try to, you know, educate the public as far as what's going on. He's like, this film and the book are the only two things I've seen of anything's going on. And I was talking to him, he was giving me some of the statistics and my jaw was like on the floor. Like I knew it was bad, but I didn't, they have the raw data at the NREMT about everything that's going on. You know, and to hear that 25% of the profession has left in the last 3 years, like who's filling those shoes? You know, are we, is EMT training and paramedic training ballooned to the point that's going to meet that exodus? Like, nope. And so the car is essentially off the cliff once I heard that, I knew the car's off the cliff and, you know, the public has no idea. And so one of the things that's going to be my kind of personal mission for this upcoming year is to use visual media to recruit, retain, and educate. And that goes back to World War II. Because I was talking to Bill after I got off the phone with him. I was thinking about, man, this is a huge problem. This is like, you know, this is like World War II problem. Like World War II needed, you know, thousands and thousands of soldiers. They needed people to man the factories. They needed, you know, all this manpower was needed to solve this public problem. And how did they achieve and get these people to do this? But one of the main things, I don't know if you remember, were the posters, World War II posters, like Uncle Sam wants you and like save scrap metal because we need it for shells. And, you know, there's a huge public information poster campaign, which is basically the social media of the time. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if someone's going to, where people congregate, the movies, okay, we're going to put these posters up in every movie theater. We're going to put them up in every shopping mall. We're going to put them up. So basically, if you're going out in public, you don't have a choice but to see, you know, what we want you to see. And so essentially I'm looking to start almost the office of medical propaganda to start producing these posters. And I'm going to, you know, talk to the NREMT. I'm talking to folks at the NAEMT. You know, I'm in contact with Ted Lee at GEMS. And so I'm going to try and put together kind of a task force and see if I can see what kind of support I can get for getting this stuff out there and starting, you know, World War II level poster campaign for those objectives, because we need to make, I want a picture of a badass paramedic next to the poster of Iron Man in the movie theater. I want medics to be
side by side. Like, you want to be a superhero? Boom, sign up to do this job because this is how you're going to save lives in the real world, my friend. So I want stuff like that. We also need stuff for part of that is I've already thought about was recruiting more mental health clinicians.
Yeah.
You know, like a poster of a dude with his head down and, you know, someone with their hand on their shoulder saying, I'm here to help. Like, you want to be that person. So you know, there's so many facets of, you know, all these different areas that are losing people that are subjected to this negative feedback loop. Those are kind of the areas that we need to attack to recruit. And then there's retention. So when you're, you know, if you're a paramedic and you're taking, you know, your loved one out to the movie theater, I want a poster that's up there that's like, there's a one, I got this awesome book. It's called The Posters That Won the War. And it's kind of a retrospective look at a lot of the different categories of wartime posters and what they're trying to achieve and the psychology of, you know, what they're trying to produce in the public. And there's one that has like a guy, you know, it's a picture like this and it's got, you know, a sailor and he's got his Submariner badge and it's got a chick with her arm like, he signed up to be a Submariner. Like, yeah, like I want something like that for paramedics. Like, oh shit, he's a paramedic. Like, damn, like that's badass. Like, I want to help that dude. You know, so like little things like that. To like, you know, you go out and you see that stuff, you're like,
yeah,
you feel that honor. Yeah. I saw a cool clip. I think it was yesterday somewhere about they were interviewing some high-ranking Army sergeant or something like that, and he was saying, you know, we can offer benefits, we can offer healthcare, we can offer pay. You know, there's so many things, external things that we can offer for compensation, you know, to join the military. He's like, but the main thing that matters and the main thing that I harp on if I'm, you know, trying to talk to someone about staying in or joining is the oath. You know, the oath of enlistment of, you know, protecting the Constitution and this and that. And it's like, if you have that burning desire, that oath, that commitment to saving lives and being a medic and you did all this training, stuff like that, that should be honored. And that should be something that you feel good about. And, you know, if you see external reminders of that as you're going through your day, to me, that's one way that could make people want to stay in the game. If they see that society is also seeing this and, you know, appreciating them, stuff like that. And then there's educating the public. In other words, scaring the public. Because if you look at some of those old World War II posters, a lot of them were not politically correct. They were not softened up at all. They had horrible stuff on there being like, do you want things to come to this? Nope. Mm-hmm. Maybe you should help out with the war effort and stuff. And so, you know, I could see the picture in my mind, you know, I'm probably one of the first, I'm looking to link up with illustrators and things like that. Cause I think illustrations are also great because photos are cool because you can see it and you can go, oh, that's, where am I? Hey, that's like me, you know, but an illustration is, you can almost put yourself, it's like a book. You almost in your mind can imagine yourself in that role and things like that. So I'd love to work with illustrators to do something like, I can see, you know, a picture of a woman on her phone, just horrified that the dispatcher is telling them that there's no ambulances available. And over their shoulder, you can see, you know, someone doing CPR on grandfather in the background at family dinner or something like that. Just that horrified look I want to capture and give to people being like, is this what you want to happen? Because this is exactly where we're heading, unless you do something to take action, and support legislation and this and that. So that's my kind of grand, my grand mission for this year is to start working on stuff like that. And you know, maybe there can be some sort of change to stem the tide of what's happening here.
Yeah. It's so important that you're kind of framing this for the civilian population because we do have, you know, there's art out there for EMS providers and for firefighters. Mm-hmm. Probably it's very kind of a closed universe in terms of, you know, the outside public even being aware of it. But the fact that you wanted to make this geared towards them and to educate them, you know, however that is, if it's hitting them over the head with a sledgehammer or artistically, that's fantastic. And I think it segues perfectly into talking about the film. We had Bryony Gilby on not that long ago speaking about EMS in crisis. It's called Honorable But Broken, narrated by Sarah Jessica Parker.
I worked in New York City in spring of 2020, and we were pretty hard hit. It was kind of like a 9/11 every day.
It was so bleak during that time. Seeing the cries and screams of people, seeing the disparity that I'm the one working on the road, no one else is on the road, and I'm taking people to the hospital, and that may be the last time they're interacting with that family member or their loved one. It got to a point where I broke.
When the pandemic hit, many people worked from home. That wasn't an opportunity that 911 EMS was afforded.
They're the third uniformed service. Their job is as dangerous as police and fire. They have been right up in the front lines taking care of very sick COVID patients, constantly exposed to infectious disease.
We met people who have been in it for a lifetime, and they've never seen it more sort of broken than it is now.
Many people assume incorrectly that EMS is considered this quote-unquote essential service. And unfortunately, in many of the legislative frameworks, EMS was just left out.
One of the biggest challenges with EMS, the way that it is structured today, is the funding mechanism, the economic model.
All across this country, EMS agencies can't recruit, retain, and staff ambulances to a point to ensure the public safety.
Particularly rural areas don't have the required EMS coverage. When someone calls 911, there's no assurance that they can get an ambulance.
People always want to talk about the cost of responding to the call, whereas we should be talking about the cost of readiness to respond to the call.
We need to have full-time paid personnel that get adequate salaries, who have chosen this as a profession. This is a noble profession.
As an EMS worker, it's very difficult to live off of one salary. Therefore, I have to work at several different agencies just to pay my bills.
It doesn't translate into money per se under state law to simply call something an essential service. We have to rebuild the EMT-EMS system from the ground up to create a system that has enough money to sustain itself.
So how'd you get involved with that, and what's what are you doing to help promote that mission?
Yeah, so I Brownie reached out to me, and she'd seen my photos out and about and stuff like that, and she reached out to me, said she was working on the film, and I said, okay, that sounds cool, and it it pretty much jives right in line with what my book is trying to do to give visibility and increase that people take care of medics and things like that. And she also told me that she has three EMS provider children. And so once she kind of said that, I was like, oh, you do get it. It's not just some like, I'm a filmmaker, I'm going to make a film about EMS. It's not like some auteur, like trying to do their masterpiece, something like that. Like, she understands and she's doing this because she has seen behind the curtain and, has heard the stories and sees the conditions firsthand. So, understanding that she had that depth of knowledge of the subject matter and what was going on really made me want to do what I could to support it. And so she asked if she could feature some of my photography in the film. I said, yeah, of course. And so they ended up using probably almost about 4 dozen images throughout the course of the film. And I couldn't be more honored to have been a part of the project. And yeah, like you mentioned, then the kind of random occurrence of Sarah Jessica Parker signing on to do the narration.
Right.
And to have someone of that kind of level of notoriety lend their voice to a project like this really touched a nerve within me, and I'm sure everyone else in the production staff and anyone who watches the film, to know that she kind of deemed this important enough of an issue to narrate for it and to put her voice and her image and her likeness on this project was almost unthinkable. I never would have imagined something like that could have gone down. And so that being the case, now we are working to try to fundraise to get the film onto a streaming platform, because that is really what I think where it needs to be. It needs to be in the home of every citizen in this country. And, you know, it should almost be mandatory viewing for things like politicians and, you know, high school kids and, you know, stuff like that. Anyone who's maybe making decisions or voting or putting together legislation, things like that. I don't see why it shouldn't be. So really the next phase is fundraising to get onto a streaming platform. And, you know, we're in ongoing talks about promotion. You know, we're trying to do more podcasts and things like that as we come up. And so whatever we kind of get the word out. And, but like I said, the film's one dimension, and that's, it's going to be huge and helpful, but we need like a multi-pronged attack, to start to correct this problem. Cause it's so huge. It's almost overwhelming for, you know, one person, even a group of people to try and think about how to address this issue. But,
well, anything we can do, you know, if we can help you get the word out, we absolutely will. We've had you and Bryony on at this point. But we commend the work that you're doing, because it's through this work that people will finally see everything behind the curtain, like you said, and it's too important to let this go. People are dying. You know, when people are dying more by their hand than the profession, we're in crisis. And so we're totally on the same page with you. And anything we can do to support that, we're here.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm stripping away a lot of other stuff I've been working on to start focusing on this, because it's easy to let this. I mean, it's so easy for me to let this fall by the wayside and be like, "Fucking, I got a lot of other shit I can worry about or deal with, or you know, make money doing or something like that." Mm-hmm. But it's all I have to do is just think about calling my wife being in an emergency and calling 911 and having to wait, or having that fucking ambulance not show up. And I'm just like, it's almost bringing me to tears right now just thinking about it. And it's like, that's my mission. You know, if you need a mission, that's my mission, is to keep that from happening. And if I have to bang on people's desks, I'll bang on desks. If I have to shout from the rafters, I will. But yeah, anytime I can get a public platform or something to talk about this and start getting the word out, I'm going to do it. I'm not going to stop there, because there's a lot of work to do, and I'm going to roll up my sleeves and get to work.
Fantastic. Well, we salute you for all that you're doing and going to do. And how can people find you? How can people find the book, the film, and anything else that's important?
Totally. Yeah. The film, honorablebutbroken.org. People can go there. They can see the trailer, meet the production team, and people can actually sign up now to do screenings. They got it through Prodigy EMS. They're able to do on-demand streaming and screening. It's still early. What time is it? Sign up for updates, things like that. And they're also fundraiser, so we're asking for donations on the ForGiving site. Links are on the webpage. We also have I have a fundraiser going on my site, dohp.net, dohp.net, and you can buy swag from the film. We have, you know, different things. You can buy the official film poster. You can also find my books, Photos from the Front Lines and Behind the Skirmish Line, on my website as well.
Great. This has been wonderful, Derek. It's really great to meet you, and we're inspired and humbled all at once. Thank you for everything you're doing.
Thank you all so much. It's been so great speaking with you, and I'd love to do it again sometime.
Absolutely. I'm sure there's more collaboration down the road. So thanks for being with us, Derek, and you know, Godspeed with all your missions.
All right. Thank you all. Be well.
You too.
Remember to like and subscribe. YouTube, Responder Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, and all the podcast platforms. Check out our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.